Navidad. Feliz Navidad, prospero año y felicidad.
It's Let's Talk here on a Thursday morning. We will have some open phone time once again coming up toward the end of the hour here today. And, of course, lots of open phone time rolling your way tomorrow.
All right, we like cute Christmas tunes, right? You're laughing. Come on, it's Christmas time anyway. Before we get to our guest, real quick. Now, we just had that caller from Tennessee. Now, I would love to say that our FM signal reaches that far. No. We do stream, I think.
Yes, the streaming is the way to go. 98.7thefox.com, and there's a live stream button right at the top. They listen to us all over the planet.
Yeah, that's kind of scary.
I like it.
Like, whoa, Tennessee. Like, okay, I wasn't expecting that, but all right. First off, let's welcome our guest, Rabbi David Ostrich. I think very well known in the Center County or Central Pennsylvania Jewish community. Rabbi Ostrich, first off, good morning, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be with y'all.
I noticed your, here's the background story on this one. You wrote an op-ed piece for the Center Daily Times a few days ago that I think probably caught a lot of eyes, definitely caught my eye. Called Who Loves the Palestinians? And I thought, ooh. Now, for folks who didn't read the piece, again, you could jump online. This was from the Center Daily Times. Go to their website, and you can probably do a little searching, and you can find it and so on. But I just saw that, Rabbi, and I'm like, oh, this is something I think I want to talk about. So let's begin with a little background, if we could, please. Tell us something about yourself, your background. I know that you were at Penn State, no longer at Penn State, and so on. Tell us something about yourself.
Okay, well, my main position here is as rabbi of the congregation Brit Shalom, the Jewish congregation here in town. I've been here for 18 years, and I came here from Florida. And the previous number of years, I'd been rabbis in Florida, Georgia, Mississippi. And I'm from Louisiana. But in the course of those years, I've lived in Israel for 2 years, gone there many of times, and studied it intensely for many years. So I feel like I know something about Israel and about the conflicts that Israel encounters. And one of the problems that we have is that there's so many different stories and so many different angles that we tend to read something quickly, sort of make a decision based on what some opinion influencer tells us, and we go on to the next story. And in this particular, and I know I do that with all kind of stories, but in this particular, I know this story, and I think that sometimes the narrative that we see or we hear are not quite right. And so I thought I'd try to shed some light on the subject by talking about, you know, the way that the Palestinians are being used or abused by a variety of different groups.
I'm just curious. I'm simply curious. How did somebody from way down south end up here in Center County, PA, two decades ago? How'd that happen?
Well, when you're a rabbi and you look for a new job, they're all over the country. And it turns out that this was not that much different. I mean, obviously, it's up north. It's a small community, which is how I've dedicated my career, in a largely agriculture area, sort of a university town agricultural area. And this is similar to the places I've served in the past, so it's not that different.
Now, I mentioned you were at Penn State, or you were an instructor or teacher or something at Penn State.
Yeah, it's a part-time, it's a part-time thing. So I did that for about 15 years.
I mean, and what were you teaching? Were you working with students?
I was teaching Jewish studies, Hebrew Bible, modern Jewish history, Jewish mysticism, things like that, and the Jewish studies program.
Actually, Rabbi, I have no idea. How many, using a rough number, there are 40,000 students at Penn State. How many of them are, how many Jewish students? I have no idea how many Jewish students there are.
Oh, the estimate is around 5,000.
Really? That many?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
And they come from where Penn State draws students, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, the Baltimore, D.C. area, New Jersey, New York. That's where a lot of Penn State students come from, and that's where a lot of the Jewish students come from.
Now, I know there's at least one. Any idea how many Israeli students are there at Penn State? Do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I mean, there are
some.
There are some, yeah.
And there are several faculty members who are from Israel.
I mean, I remember when, and it's been 2 months now, you know, the war going on in Israel, Gaza, and so on. And I'm trying to think who the outlet was. It might have been Fox, might have been CNN. I can't remember which one. They did an interview with a Penn State student who was on their way back to Israel because they were also in the Defense Force. And I guess they got called back. And this was, the person was identified as a Penn State student. I'm like, oh, my. I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah, well, you know, the way it works in Israel is when people leave high school, both boys and girls, they go to the Army. And after they finish the Army, then they go to university. And but when there's an emergency, actually, people go back for reserves every year for a week or two or three, just, you know, for operations and training. But when there's an emergency, they call people back, and it's not at all unusual. This happens every time there's a crisis in Israel. They'll call people who happen to be abroad back, you know, for their reserve units.
Now, in your time when you were doing, you know, teaching and so on at Penn State, I know that there are also Palestinian students at Penn State. I have no idea of a number. Did you, now you're a professor or a teacher of Jewish studies, did you ever encounter Palestinian students during your time there?
Yeah. To tell you the truth, generally the students, I don't ask for their backgrounds, but some people tell me, but what I do ask for, or it comes up in class discussions, is their religion. And so we've had quite a few Muslims in my classes over the years. We're curious about, you know, I taught one course in Christianity and Judaism, sort of the foundations of that. So we get some people from other religions in that as well.
Huh. Very interesting. To the piece that you wrote for the Center Daily Times, first of all, just how did that idea for the column come about? Obviously, you're watching the conflict, but I mean, it is a pretty basic question that I'm not sure a lot of people take the time to truly think about the way you obviously have.
Well, I think what happens a lot of times is that people make a very quick decision about what is right or wrong in a conflict without thinking of the implications of the policies. And in this particular case, one of the big overriding paradigms that people put on the policy on the situation over there is, you know, indigenous people versus colonizers. And I think this is really incorrect. And so this is my complaint about the UN and a lot of human rights organizations, is that when they say, well, let the locals sort of run their own thing, what if the locals are oppressive? What if the locals are a bunch of thugs like Hamas who deny human rights or who use humanitarian aid for terrorist operations? One of the reasons that you don't have water, there's a water shortage right now in Gaza, is because Hamas is commandeering most of the oil shipments that come into Gaza and using it for their generators. And so the large desalinization plant and all the wells that need, you know, fuel to pump are not able to operate. So it's not a matter of Israel denying it or the international aid not coming in, but Hamas takes the oil. So,
right.
Like, you know, when you say let the locals rule, it's like, well, but who's going to rule? Is it just because they have, you know, they're Arabs that makes them local and okay? Or does that mean that they're possibly bad people who happen to be Arabs who are oppressing the other people? And, you know, and the same thing with the Jordanians and the Lebanese who don't want the Palestinians in. And this problem's been going on for a long time. And I think that the complexities are important in terms of understanding it. And the poor Palestinian people have been victimized so many ways and deprived in so many ways. And even the aid that comes in, more aid, I've heard that more aid per capita goes to the Palestinian refugee population than any other group in the world, any other refugee group in the world, and there are hundreds of them. And yet, when that aid is diverted, instead of schools and hospitals and housing and things like that, is diverted to terrorist operations, the people are still in bad shape. And it's just tragic. So if people really are concerned about the plight of the Palestinian people, then it takes a little more analysis to see who is causing the problems. And in our opinions and whatever we do in terms of, you know, suggesting things to our congresspeople, things like that, we need to be aware of, you know, who are causing the problems and who need to be corrected.
All right. Now, Rabbi, for folks that didn't read the piece from a few days ago, I'd kind of give us the Cliff Notes version, if you will. What did you have in the op-ed that you posted the other day?
Okay, well, so I said, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Palestinians and about their aspirations, their rights, their situation. But just ask the question, who loves the Palestinians? And I go down a list, you know, is it the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, or the Palestine Liberation Organization? No, they abuse them. They steal the money for their own, you know, wealthy, they would increase their own bank accounts, the leaders do this. Is it Lebanon? Is it Syria? Is it Jordan? Is it Egypt? No, they don't want the Palestinians. That's why they're not letting them out of Gaza. And that's why they didn't even incorporate them in their society from 1948 to 1967. They wouldn't let them in. They left them in squalid refugee camps. So though they may talk about the, you know, the brotherhood of Islam or the brotherhood of the Arabs, they're not really showing kind of brotherhood, kind of loyalty and concern other than setting them up for more war. The United Nations is letting the terrorists operate under their noses. They actually print up books that are very hateful. A lot of the human rights organizations ignore the fact that, you know, terrible abuses occur under the Arab rules, and they just don't seem to worry about that. I mean, like the fact that gays and lesbians are just absolutely prohibited or hounded or harassed or killed doesn't seem to be an issue. Women are not allowed rights and things like this. So I go down the list of all these different countries and organizations and say they're not really showing love to the Palestinians. And among the groups are Hamas, because Hamas takes the money for humanitarian purposes. Hamas uses them as human shields. And this is not love. This is, you know, using these people as pawns. And then the final point I make is that, ironically, the best place for Arabs in the Middle East is Israel, because the Arab citizens of Israel have more freedom, more economic opportunity, more cultural autonomy than any of the and more individual rights than any almost any other Arabs in the world, and in the Arab. Not in the United States so much, but in the Arab countries over there. You can be lesbian, you can be gay, you can be a woman who wants to work outside the home, you can have political rights. The government actually has four major television and radio networks, one of which is Arabic language all the time. Arabic is one of the primary languages, official legal languages of Israel. Street signs, legal documents are all in this. So even though there are issues between Arabs and Jews, on balance, the Arabs who live in Israel are better off than the Arabs who live pretty much anywhere else, with the exception of rich people in Saudi Arabia. You know, that's a whole different story.
Yeah, actually, let's fill in here. Now, Rabbi, this is Scott, all right? I've never been to Israel. I'd like to go sometime, bucket list. I mean, I'm Christian. I go to church every week. I'd love to go to Jerusalem, Bethlehem. This time of year, I'd love to go to Bethlehem. You know, maybe Nazareth and some other places. But you kind of hit it there. I think a lot of people think that every Israeli is Jewish, and that's not the case, right?
No, there are lots of non-Jewish Israelis. I mean, the majority are Jewish. It's a majority Jewish state, but there are lots of Arabs, most of whom are Muslim, many of whom are Christian. There are also other groups called Druze. And then the Bedouins, who are technically Arab and technically Muslim, but it's a little different cultural group. They're more nomadic and live out in the desert and things like that. But there are other groups as well, and plus there are other groups from around the world. I don't know if you noticed in the accounts of the massacre on October 7th, but quite a few of the people who were there were places from places like Thailand or a place like the Philippines, because you have guest worker programs where these people come over and work in agriculture or in, you know, personal care kinds of things, and they send money back to their families. It really bankrolls a lot of the poor families in other parts of the world, and there are a lot of them in Israel. So you have Jews from all over the world, many of whom are not what you think of when you think of an Eastern European Jew, which is what most Jews are in the United States. These are Jews from Morocco, from Yemen, from Iraq, from Persia, Iran, from all these different parts of the world. And they look like people from there. When I was in my previous position, when I was in Florida, there were two rabbis in town. I'm very European looking. When I go to Europe, people start speaking to me in German, even though I don't speak German. I guess I must look German. And then the other rabbi's family was from Yemen, and he looks like a person from Yemen. You know, dark skin, you know, Arabic, you know, facial features, things like this. Because the Jews from all these other parts of the world look like the people from those parts of the world. So if one wants to think of Israel as a white place, it's majority non-white, you know, because the Jews from Morocco are Moroccans, and the Jews from Algeria are Algerian, and the Jews from Iran and the Jews from Iraq are those other places like that. So a lot of racial diversity among the people who, though we trace our ancestry back to Abraham, we've been dispersed throughout the world for a long, long time, and there are lots of different Jewish ethnic groups are represented in Israel.
Our guest again is Rabbi David Ostrich from the local Jewish community here in State College. We're going to take a break and play Christmas music again. All right, there we go. Not sure if that timing is apropos or not. We're going to come back. We're going to continue the conversation about this very serious issue going on half a world away, but it does affect us in different ways. You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox as we celebrate Christmas Eve stuff. We'll come right back.
For the Goon and Ironhead, exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7
The Fox.
Despite a tough season for the Commanders with a 4-9 record quarterback, Howell still speaks highly of his team, especially McLaurin, who he describes as a great player, leader, and role model. Despite his own stats of 3,466 yards, 18 touchdowns, and 14 interceptions, and McLaurin's 2 touchdown receptions, Howell believes they are still working well together. He maintains that the relationships with his receivers are good and that they continue to practice hard to improve their performance on the field.
The Fox!
The entertainment world has been buzzing with Google's annual Year in Search list. For 2023, Barbie took the spotlight, leading the movie trends, closely followed by Oppenheimer and the Indian thriller, Juan. As for TV shows, The Last of Us, Wednesday, and Ginny and Georgia kept viewers on the edge of their seat. It's clear that 2023 was a year of thrilling entertainment, with these trends reflecting our global fascination. Come along as we dive deeper into these captivating stories.
Here's your Ocean State Job Loss Foxcast. Plenty of sunshine today, high 40, partly cloudy, not as cold tonight, low 25 to 30, and some sunshine tomorrow and Saturday with highs of 45 to 50.
Fox Forecast.
Big rainstorm coming later Sunday into Monday, and then it's going to turn colder. It may snow at the end of that. This is WeatherBell.com Chief Meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox.
Hi, this is Corey Comfort from Joel Comfort Toyota in State College. Are you looking for a dealership to call home? Joel Comfort Toyota is a locally owned family business that has been serving the community for over 45 years. Come see us and let us help you with your next vehicle experience. We're located at 120 East Clinton Avenue in State College, just behind the Waffle Shop on North Athens Street. Or visit us 24/7 at joelcomfort.com. And remember, good things happen in your community when you buy local.
The title and tag service that is customer-friendly and locally owned is at Joel Confort Quality Pre-Owned in Pleasant Gap. And as part of the Joel Confort family of dealerships, Monica Prisk is experienced and has been serving customers for 13 years. Cameron Confort is on the title and tag team and is there to help you with all of your title and tag needs. Stop at Joel Confort Quality Pre-Owned at 475 East College Avenue in Pleasant Gap and have Monica or Cameron answer any of your title and tag questions. Remember, good things happen in your community when you buy local.
Don't know what to get that special loved one? How about a relaxing getaway for two to the Keller House Bed and Breakfast? Comfy quarters and memorable mornings await you and your loved one with a romantic getaway to Center Hall, just minutes from Penn State and Penn's Cave. Relax, refresh, and recharge with a getaway to the Keller House Bed and Breakfast. Make a reservation now by calling 814-364-2225. That's the Keller House Bed and Breakfast in Center Hall.
Santa's coming to town!
Santa!
Oh my. The Fox Sports 98.7 with the original Christmas Wish Contest. Santa Fox wants to grant your Christmas wish during the 12 days of Christmas.
What's this?
This is the North Pole.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Yes, it is.
No, it's not. Where's the snow?
Email us your Christmas wish at thefoxsports987@gmail.com. That's thefoxsports987@gmail.com.
Totally up to Santa Fox, but you may be one of the lucky Fox fans. Get your wish granted.
And you don't even have to sit on Santa's lap.
You sit on a throne of lies. Not like beef and cheese. You don't smell like Santa.
It's the original Christmas wish gift contest.
From the radio station that believes in keeping Jesus Christ in Christmas.
Ho, 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 ho! Merry Christmas!
Sports Radio 98.7. That's fun!
Turn it up! Turn it up! Turn it up!
Get up and get going with the Happy Valleys 98.7 The Fox.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Good girl, Santa baby, I'm hurried down the chimney tonight.
It is Let's Talk on a Thursday morning. Jeff and Scott with you. Again, some open phone time coming up in the final segment of this morning's show.
Yeah, we might have to change those around a little bit. Just timing and so on. Anyway, we're just having some fun. Our guest again is Rabbi David Ostrich from the Brit Shalom congregation here in State College, talking about, in part, an op-ed that Rabbi Ostrich wrote that was published in the Center Daily Times just a few days ago. Rabbi, I'm just curious. When October 7th happened, what was your reaction? When you heard the news, when you saw the news, read the news, what was your initial reaction to that?
Well, it was terrible shock. It was just terrible, terrible shock. And as the story details emerged, just real grief and anger, and you know, trying to figure out, first of all, how did this happen? How did Israel's wanted security, you know, not realize what's going on? And also concern for the victims and the and the hostages, and no, it was a very, very, very upset reaction. And you know, of course, as always in these developing stories, as time goes on, you begin to think about more and more angles of it, and you know, this has been taking a lot of energy and a lot of thought and trying to figure out what's going on, a lot of listening just to, you know, the media and looking to reports and things like that. So this has really consumed a lot of attention over the last number of months.
All right. Now, obviously, you're from here, but you have connections over mm-hmm. there. And yeah. What the rest of us see is, you know, what we read in the papers, what we see on TV and so on. From your conversations, I guess, that you've had with folks over there over the last 2 months, how are they mm-hmm. reacting? Is it different from what we're maybe seeing on TV pretty much every night now?
Well, it's a weird thing. You know, the complexity, I think, is the main thing that strikes me from what I've heard people over there. First of all, my sister lives there with her children, so we're on the phone with them or on WhatsApp with them all the time. So we have a lot of contact and hear what's going on. And it's complexity, a lot of complexity, and oftentimes what is presented in you know, the media is just not complex enough to adequately express what's going on. Just an example. Yesterday I heard on NPR, they used the phrase indiscriminate bombing, Israel's indiscriminate bombing. Thinking, how would they know it's indiscriminate, first of all? Secondly, why would a military running out of ammunition indiscriminately fire anything? You know, it doesn't make sense. Now, who does do indiscriminate bombing is are the Arab groups, you know, the Hamas and the other terrorist groups, because they don't have good guidance systems, which I guess we should thank God that they don't have good guidance systems. But they're, I mean, like a lot of the bombs that they shoot off in the in Gaza don't leave Gaza. They explode and fall down in Gaza, killing civilians there. Or they'll go, I know where my sister lives, one of the missiles hit nearby, and there's an Arab village right next door to where her village, and it seriously injured a Palestinian man. So here you have this guy who's not involved, who's, you know, and all of a sudden he's injured and by a rocket, you know, shot by a Palestinian. So indiscriminate is just an inaccurate term used. And so things like that, I think, are not doing a service to truth. You know, we can have our criticisms of Israeli policy and Israel decisions, but it seems to me that it's almost like what we love in America are good stories, and whether or not they actually reflect the truth is of secondary importance. And that's really upsetting. And it makes me wonder about every other story I've read about someplace where I don't know the details, where I don't have personal contacts. So this has been one of the big issues, is the pervasive narrative that seems to be coming across in a lot of the reports that doesn't reflect the complexity, the facts on the ground.
Well, to me, one of the things that they seem to be doing is that this is beyond frustrating, and I genuinely don't understand where it is coming from, but there seems to be this driving, well, we need to look at the equivalency, and yes, you know, it was awful what happened on October 7th, but look, there's innocent people dying now as a result of, the Israeli fire, and so yes, both sides are to... I can't imagine. I have difficulty processing this. These are not equivalent acts, and how you can't possibly see that, and why there is such an effort to continue to try to drive that equivalency. On one hand, again, you have a group of people who are purposely going after innocent civilians. Purposely going after children, beheading them in front of their parents, celebrating, laughing, popping champagne corks, finding this hilarious, raping women. On the other hand, you have people who are battling for their survival and doing everything they can to avoid. It's war. We get it. There will be innocent lives lost. Yeah. It is horrible. Nobody wants that. But to not see the difference here between the two groups is... I can't even, frustrating is not anywhere near a strong enough term, but there seems to be this driving effort in the American media in particular to, yes, boy, it was awful what Hamas did, but look, Israel's killing innocent people too. What are you doing here? Do you have any idea why this drive is occurring?
I don't really know. It's one of the great questions. But I'm talking about the complexity that's not reflected in the reports. I mean, just for instance, the places that were attacked on October 7th, these kibbutzim and villages that were fairly close to the Gaza Strip, these are not in the occupied territories. Remember, Israel set up in 1948, and there were certain sections that were parts of Jordan or parts of Egypt. The Gaza Strip is part of Egypt. And then in 1967, as a result of the war, Israel took over some of those areas, and those are called the occupied territories. And these have been controversial. But the places that were attacked were not. In fact, a lot of the people there chose to live there because they didn't want to live in the occupied territories. There's a lot of controversy in Israel about whether Jews should be in the occupied territories, and a lot of people don't want to. It's a kind of a, we're for Palestinian rights. We want to eventually give those lands back to the Palestinians, so we don't want to live there. And the people who were attacked were the peaceniks. They were the peaceniks and hippies and the people who, and I say that affectionately, they were the people who've been working for Palestinian rights. There's this one elderly woman who was killed who's like been a lifelong advocate for Palestinian rights, and she was the one who was killed. So it's like, It's if it weren't so tragic, I would feel sorry for people who are like doing a disservice to their own cause by attacking people who are actually trying to help them. And it's tragic. It's tragic, and it's tragic for the people who. It's tragic for the Palestinians themselves, because this kind of terrorism and this kind of horrible behavior is not going to help their cause. And as much as the media in America has been pushing this, some of the media in America has been pushing this anti-Israel sentiment, the fact is a lot of Americans are not fooled by it, and a lot of Americans are really angry, and it's bad for the Palestinians and the Arabs in America, because it gives this noble religion a reputation of being bloodthirsty and cruel, and it's bad all around, and this is not a good thing for anyone, and it's a real shame. It's a real, real shame.
All right. Now, Rabbi, this is Scott. I'm a history guy, but I'll never claim to know everything. I've gone to church and Sunday school, so I know Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Joshua, David, Solomon, you know, all the basics. But can you give us just sort of a history lesson here on where this all came from? And you mentioned 1948, but I know it goes back way beyond that. Give us kind of a brief, from your point of view, a brief history lesson of this entire conflict. How far back does this go?
Well, I think a lot of people try to say that it goes back to the, you know, the fight between Abraham's two sons, Ishmael and Isaac, or the conflict between them. I don't know if that's really accurate. I think that's trying to put a biblical veneer on this very modern conflict. What happened is there have been Jews living in the land of Israel, you know, for 3,000 years. And historians will sometimes argue when, 2,500 years ago, 2,700 years ago, things like this. But we know, like from Psalm 137, which is the one they sang in the Babylonian exile. So this is a pretty sure date that in 586 before the Common Era, the kingdom of Judah was attacked and destroyed. In Jerusalem, the temple were destroyed by the Babylonians. A big exile occurred. People went to Babylon. And there we have a record of something they wrote. It says, "By the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept when we remembered thee, Zion." Zion is a mountain in Jerusalem and is used as a reference for all of Jerusalem and all of Israel. So we know the Jews have been there a long time. Arabs have been there for quite a while as well. There are Arabs living there pretty much all along, though they oftentimes were various different tribes and would not have recognized the term Arab as a reference to them. But there have been Arabs. But the majority of people involved in the conflict, that is the people in 1948, these are people who came in the 20th century, both Jewish and Arab. A lot of the land was pretty moribund. There was not a lot going on economically. And if you read some travelers' records from people like Mark Twain or Herman Melville, who visited in the 1800s, they report a place that didn't have much going on at all economically, very small population. But when the Jewish pioneers from the years in late 1800s, early 1900s, wanted to come back for Jewish nationalism, which is a whole other story, they turned a moribund place without much going on economically into a real garden. And this attracted lots of Arabs from Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, who came for jobs. And then when the British took over in the mandate from 1917, after World War One, they brought in a lot of people from other countries to work in their administration of railroads and things like that. This happened in India, happened in Africa, wherever the British were in charge, and a lot of Arabs came in for that. Among the Arabs who came in for that were Yasser Arafat, the head of the Palestine Liberation Organization. So the idea that there are these people living there for thousands of years that the Jews displaced is simply not true. Now, that doesn't mean that the people who came in and who were displaced in 1948 War of Independence do not deserve rights. But the narrative of white Europeans displacing dark-skinned Middle Easterners is just not true. It's just not true. And so this is part of the story, that there's been a squabbles between the Jews and Muslims, or Jews and Arabs, most of whom Muslims, some of whom are Christian, for years and years and years. And in 1947, the United Nations, newly formed, said, you know, we can fix this. Let's divide the country into several zones. There can be, like, I think, three or four Arab zones, three or four Jewish zones, and that was a part of the plan passed by the United Nations. By the way, Russia, Soviet Union, voted for this. They were supporters of Israel back then. In any event, the Jewish groups accepted the partition plan, and the Arab groups did not. In fact, the Arab response to this was that five Arab armies invaded, and it was touch and go there for quite a while. But eventually, the Israelis prevailed in this war we call it the War of Independence. And they were able to have their country. But meanwhile, there have been squabbles and wars ever since, as basically the Arab groups, and we're not talking about just the Palestinians, we're talking about the Arab groups in general, have been unaccepting of Israel's right to exist. And though a lot of land was seized in the 1967 Six-Day War, in my opinion, I think a lot of opinions, a lot of Israelis, all of that land, almost every inch of that land was on the table for negotiation if the Arab countries would have just said, we accept your right to exist and we'll stop trying to destroy you. But they wouldn't. And so Israel has been put in this very defensive position for all these years, has managed to survive, but it's really a fairly modern conflict, and it's a very tragic conflict.
Rabbi, we got about 30 seconds left. Just an opinion. Is there any peaceful solution, not only to what's going on today, but looking into the future? Is there any peaceful solution here?
I think we were looking at the beginning of a peaceful solution with the Abraham Accords and possibility of peace of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, when you're the biggest player in the region, you carry a lot of weight. And some would say that this whole attack was to derail the Saudi Arabian peace initiative. And so it's just a matter of getting rid of Hamas. This is a malevolent player who's not going to be constructive in any way. Getting rid of Hamas and then getting back on that process of trying to work out peace, because peace is in everyone's best interest.
Rabbi, we greatly appreciate your time this morning. I think I learned a few things here.
Yes, and, thank you very, very much.
And maybe we'll be in touch again sometime. We may be, depending on how this goes, we might have you on again sometime if you'd like to do that.
I'm happy to talk, and I appreciate the opportunity to, like I said, shed some light on this very difficult and complicated subject.
Thank you again very, very much.